Hello and welcome to the EMJ podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. Today I'm joined by Professor Joshua Makawa, York Family Professor of Medicine and Bioengineering and Director and Co-Founder of the Stanford Bio Center for Biodesign at Stanford University. Josh graduated from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, my daughter's university, with a degree in mechanical engineering. He then went on to obtain his medical degree from New York University School of Medicine. He also obtained a master's in business administration from Columbia. Put together medicine, engineering, and business, it's no surprise where his career led. And he's a chap that I've held in high esteem pretty much from a distance, not just for his many achievements, but because he is humble, approachable, and has continued to contribute to making people's lives better by perpetually finding new ways to innovate. Professor Makawa's work has been recognized by many folks, and he's a member of the National Academy of Engineering and a fellow of the American Institute of Biomedical Engineering and the National Academy of Inventors. He holds, wait for it, over 300 patents, and for my American listeners, patents, and patent applications for various medical devices in the fields of cardiology, ENT, general surgery, drug delivery, obesity, orthopedics, women's health, and urology. I think it might have been easier to say what he doesn't have IP in. Josh currently serves on the board of directors for Moximed, Willow Innovations, X9, Corvin, Elevage, to name a few, and he's a senior advisor to Patient Square Capital and an advisory venture partner at Sofinnova Partners, and he's previously worked with other investment houses. He's the founder and executive chairman of Exploramed, a medical device incubator dedicated to the development of new solutions to meet the health needs of patients worldwide. In his spare time, and it's quite frankly astonishing to think that he has any, Josh plays bass in a fantastic band called Still Trust, which we are 100% going to dive into. Professor Joshua Makawa, Josh, it's an honor and pleasure to have you here with us today.
It's an honor for me as well, and thanks for so much for that generous introduction, Jonathan.
It's not generous, it's damn accurate. You know, one of the things I've really liked about you over the years, when I've approached you, you've always been approachable, and you're very good at giving, if you know, it's an investment or whatever it might be, you're very good at giving a fast no, which is the second best answer. So many people mess people around, and you never have, and I take my hat off to you, sir. But listen, first of all, I have to start by asking about the band, Still Trust. I know you've been at it for quite a while. I've yet to see you play live, but I've watched some videos from the bitter end online and seen descriptors of the band as Steely Dan with an edge or quirky rock or kind of ecstasy and a little bit of Todd Rundgren with Beatle harmonies. I'm in awe of anyone who can do one thing well. And docs who are also musicians, and I know quite a few, inspire more than all. So talk us through all of it. Tell us about your musical career, where your interest in music came from, starting the band, and how it still plays a role in your life today.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I love it that we're starting with that. Because I honestly, little known fact, I started college as a music major. And now a lot of people know, I guess.
Now a lot of people know.
Exactly. Music has been a very important part of my life. It's my release. It's the place I go to unwind and, you know, take all the stresses of the rest of the world out. And even as a, you know, from I picked up my first instrument, I think, around the age of 5, ultimately focused on trumpet. I was, you know, inspired by Herb Alpert, if anyone remembers who that is. And then realized that playing trumpet was not the best way to, you know, find girls. And so I changed over to a stringed instrument, and I found bass and absolutely love it. It's it supports the band. It's everywhere. It's always on. And it's just part of the rhythm section. So it's a great supportive instrument that just threads through everything. And I love the bass. My brother and I formed Still Trust with a bunch of friends from high school. And we have been playing together ever since. Our last performance was in New York City at a place called The Bitter End. We've put out a couple of albums. Yeah, it's my major creative outlet. I write, I co-write, I sing, and I love it. It's a great release.
So first of all, we will put some links into the show notes to Still Trust. And just want to throw out there that a prior guest and a dear old friend of mine, Carl Hauser, who's a professor of surgery and a trauma expert in Boston. Carl has been, he's been a guest here, as I said, and he's been in a band, The Druids. They were originally the Druids of Stonehenge, and they've been playing together also since high school. He's a few years older than you, Josh, but I just, and there's also a mate of mine here in London who we've yet to have on, so I won't mention his name, who's a colorectal surgeon, very, very prominent and very esteemed and gentlemanly, and at night he becomes a punk rocker. And kudos to you, man, kudos to you. So putting aside your musical career, talk us through your educational progression. I hinted at the front that there's no surprise you went the way you did, but did you see that acquiring the particular training you received would take you in this professional direction?
In my professional career, the things that inspired me were some of the original shows that, you know, the Million Dollar Man. I don't know if anybody remembers that. It's a story of an astronaut that gets, horribly wounded in a crash. And
inflation hit, Josh, and he was the $6 million man.
Oh, you know what? You're right. The $6 million man. Yes. thank you for that. He gets rebuilt, his eyes, his legs, his arm. And, you know, to me, that was the superhero that I was most excited about because I saw the potential of making that all real. And so that inspired me and sort of my path first at MIT, working on health technologies there. And then the question was, how shall I learn more about the body, the real human condition, the challenges that the body has, disease, et cetera. And it was a natural thing to step towards medical school. And so I entered medical school very differently than most folks looking for a career in medicine necessarily. I thought that I would be a doctor practicing, but also innovating at the same time. And just as my training went on, I just realized that for me, I'm very impatient and I like to get things done. And I just saw the path of staying a physician and also being an innovator as being much, much longer. And I just wanted to get to the innovation part sooner. So after graduating from medical school, I went to work in business. And my first real job after medical school was working for Pfizer Medical Devices, which at the time Pfizer had a $2 billion traditional med tech business within it. Composed of multiple technologies, orthopedic hips, you know, cardiovascular, et cetera. And so that's where I went. And thankfully, I was able to convince them to pay for me to go through business schools. And that sort of rounded me out and gave me the confidence to step out into the real world and start creating my own companies.
Well, and you've done it brilliantly. And I want to talk a little bit about BioDesign because there may be some folks who don't know about BioDesign. It's pretty much revolutionized the field. Tell us about the creation. It originated at Stanford, but it's a concept. I've written about it and told people about it over the years. Please tell everyone how it works and how it's changed the innovation pathway.
Yeah, you bet. And actually, the methodology originated when I was working for Pfizer. The CEO of Pfizer, at that time, he was the VP of strategic planning, Hank McKinnell, sent me on a specific project, which was a side job. It wasn't my main job. He wanted me to go speak. He wanted me to understand why is it that they buy all these little businesses that are just innovating like crazy, and then they get inside of Pfizer and they stop innovating as dramatically. And so it was a curiosity to him. He's somewhat frustrated with it because they didn't live up to their expectations for the most part. And so it gave me license to go interview the original founders of all those companies and their teams and also the current executives running and executing on those businesses inside of Pfizer, which usually were different people. And the key thing that I noticed was that when they're starting their companies, they're really starting chasing after a problem or a need and finding technologies to bring to it that match the need the best. And of course, a whole bunch of other organizational benefits of, you know, having only one thing to focus on. Whereas when the teams are inside of the big company, they become the balloon company. You know, having successfully conquered angioplasty, then they go try to find other places where they can put balloons, which isn't always as dramatic in its innovation potential or upside potential. And so I brought this back and I said, look, these are all the features of the differences between what happens before and after. But I think there's nothing that happens after that can't happen in a big company. You just need to carve a little group away, have them focus on the need, not pay attention to the investments we've made historically or characterize any technologies as off the list. And that's how you do it. And he said, well, go prove it. And I created my own group called the Fresh Tech group, or the Pfizer Strategic Planning Group, Strategic Innovation Group, I'm sorry. And we proved over several years that we absolutely could take Pfizer into new spaces and invent and create new technologies that solved unmet needs and represented really exciting business opportunities for Pfizer. And that's how Biodesign began. It was the process that we laid down to try to institutionalize the process of innovation for a big company. The challenges then became more political in terms of, you know, not invented here and trying to get these opportunities back into the businesses where, in some cases, the actual business franchise itself was being threatened by the new technology. So they didn't want to see it proceed. And, you know, I'd say things like, you know, if we do this, we'll prevent other people from doing it. So we should get in front of it. But that didn't really convince many of the leaders. So we found ourselves just very frustrated often. And that prompted me to lead to start ExploreMed. We didn't create Biodesign until much later in the year 2000. I sat down with Paul Yock, who I'd worked with on one of my companies, Transvascular. And Paul's a very experienced and successful inventor in the cardiovascular space. And he was looking for something unique to do at Stanford that would differentiate Stanford and really create a training ground for the medical device opportunities that were all around Stanford. And I brought up this idea, you know, look, I have this innovation methodology. I've taught it to, you know, we used it in Pfizer. I've taught it to others. Others have been successful with it. I've been successful with it. Maybe we can transition this into an educational program to teach others and share it with the world and really expand the dimensions of innovation and bring something a unique training experience to the medical device space. And we created Biodesign, and our first class of fellows was 2001. And I could share a little bit of what the process actually is if you like.
Yeah, please go ahead, Josh.
So the basic idea is there's a textbook on this, so I'll be very brief. For those that want to see, there's a ton of content on the web. And so the basic idea is you can innovate in any space that you wish, and it doesn't matter what background you have. In fact, sometimes coming in naively into a space is a benefit because everyone in the space is completely biased towards whatever they learned in their training, and they can't really see beyond the emergency that's in front of them one after the next. So the doctors, unfortunately, in many of these settings are so busy, they do not have the time to pick their heads up. I mean, Jonathan, you're one of the few people that that has done that and has you know, have the ability to do both, but many, many physicians are just, you know, working very heads down, not thinking about any way of changing what they do and just trying to get their workload done. And so number one is choose the space you want to be in. Be strategic about it. This could be as a big company or as an individual. Second, when you choose that space, go in and see what the real problems are in that space by experiencing it yourself. Find yourself a way to shadow physicians that work in that environment, understand what the payer environment is for that group, you know, what the patients' lives are like. Really try to holistically understand all the stakeholders that are engaged in that space. And a little in a very short amount of time, you will see the needs, some significant needs start to rise to the top that are truly unmet and that are substantial. And if you use sort of a straightforward ranking system, you will find yourselves very quickly towards a very big and exciting opportunity to solve a big problem for people in that space. Then this next question is, well, how do you solve it? The first step in that process is to create a set of criteria that need to be met for it to be solved successfully. So again, you've not invented it yet. You're just setting what the criteria are. So for example, if you know that someone has high blood pressure and you know you want to treat high blood pressure, well, the question is, how low does it need to get for it to be considered a success? That's a parameter. And you identify all these parameters across the physiology, but also the patient's need. And then what is tolerable from the system in terms of payment or value? Is this going to add cost or is it going to truly bring value? Those are all parts of the criteria that you would consider in this framework prior to inventing anything. Once you've created that criteria, then you have a platform to truly invent. And every time you get to the whiteboard and you put another idea down, you can look over that criteria and ask yourself, which ones of these criteria am I addressing the best? Which ones am I not addressing? And that can spur on even more thoughtful innovation towards the goal of trying to address as many of those criteria as possible, as successfully as possible. And that can result in the best solution that you can take forward into the next steps in the process. Then the next step is very rigorous. What's the clinical pathway for something like this? What are the patents look like? What do the regulatory pathways look like? How much capital is it going to take? How long is it going to take? And as you assess each of these projects, little by little, one or two or three start to fall out because, oh, this is not patentable, or this is way too expensive, a clinical trial. And little by little, you whittle it down until hopefully you've got one or two on the other side that actually reasonably are worth investing in to see a proof of concept and see if it works. And so that holistically is the process that we teach at Stanford Biodesign, and that I've used my entire career to create all the companies and technologies that I've been affiliated with.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a great strategy. And I use that term in its broader sense. You know, the other thing that I learned, it was an epiphany when this guy explained it to me, a chap named Andy Sleet. So big shout out to you, Andy. He said to me that people start a company because it's something that they know a lot about or something they're passionate about, or preferably both. But running a company has got nothing to do with those things. It's things like raising money, finding a facility, HR. And it was very sweet of you to say that I've been successful. If any success I've had, Josh, has been because I've gathered people around me who are smarter and better looking and can do all those things and get the hell out the way. And, you know, being a CEO, for God's sake, it's not a very attractive job sometimes.
And by the way, Jonathan, I do the same thing. It's very important to know what your strengths and your weaknesses are. That's like the first thing you do in the process is take a personal inventory, because the places where you're weak, you need to add those folks as your team members.
Yeah.
And so a really good understanding of what you do well and not is super important to being successful. And absolutely, I do the same thing. There are so many things that I know I would not be the right person for. And that's why I'm always pairing up with, you know, an engineer that knows how to build it and make it happen. And I can list the names of the folks in the various companies who that's been.
I love, there was a wonderful quote about Lincoln that when he was forming his cabinet, one of his advisors said, "You've appointed a secretary of the treasury, a man who considers himself smarter than you, wiser than you, better than you." And Lincoln's response was, "Find me an entire cabinet of people like that." always smarter and better looking. So yeah. As someone who's, you've helped drive multiple technologies from mind to marketplace, give us your perspective on how budding inventors, entrepreneurs, and I agree with you, anyone can do this, who are out there working in a community hospital or an academic medical center, they've had an idea, they want to commercialize it. When's the right time to take it from that environment to the outside world.
Yes. I love the way you phrase that, because already in the way you phrased the question is part of the problem. Quite often people in a clinical environment, they have an idea. But the problem is that have they gone through that rigorous process of truly identifying what the need is? And quite often not. So they have an idea, which is great, because that means you can create things. Congratulations. But does that idea actually meet the need? And is it the right idea to meet the need? Is it the best idea to meet the need? It's the rigorous process that should go before the idea that many, many physicians miss. And as a result, they careen forward trying to assemble a company or get money or whatever it is, or even invest in grants or studies. And there's a fundamental premise of the idea that is being missed. It's maybe too expensive to implement, maybe not the right technology to solve that problem, whatever. The next part of your question, of course, is when is the right time to create a company around it? And I agree, many, many projects need more evaluation, especially if they've got a certain degree of science that needs to be proven. And proving science in a truly commercial environment is very difficult and can make investors very frustrated and can be actually quite expensive. We take for granted the infrastructure that we have around us in the academic world, and one really should take it as far as possible in that setting to prove out the scientific questions as much as possible before exiting. I think at the point of that you've got a proof of concept that seems to be working, at least in some framework, that would be a great time to take something out.
Yeah, another shout out to another friend, Paul Ferris, an Englishman who was managing director, CEO of a company doing prototyping, product design and development. And I went to see him many years ago with a design for a lighting concept I dreamed up, and I wanted him to build a prototype. And he sat across the desk after I'd shown it to him, and there was a period of silence as he looked at me and he said, "What makes you think this is a good idea?" I said, "Well, because I've had this issue and I've had that issue in lighting this particular surgical procedure or that." And he says, "Maybe you're the problem." Frankly, Josh, I'm a professor. People don't talk to me like that. But I was intrigued. And he said, "Yeah," he says, "maybe you're the problem. Maybe other people don't have that problem." And he said, "And assuming it is a problem, what makes you think this is the right design?" And I ended up, we became dear friends. We ended up starting a company together to actually work out, to do needs assessment. And I echo everything you said to anyone out there. There's a program that the NIH in America and the National Science Foundation run called the ICOR program, which is for any inventors out there, look it up, ICORPS. I went on it and boy, I learned so much. It was an amazing, amazing thing. Political question for you, Josh. Bunch yes. of years ago, I wrote an editorial that addressed doctors collaborating with industry. It was in response to the hostility that was faced by medics, especially in America, in the wake of the so-called Sunshine Act and other barriers to doctors engaging in collaborations with industry. I made my feelings known in that article, and we can stick it in the show notes. It's many years ago, actually. But I don't think things have changed. What are your thoughts about it? You worked for Pfizer and worked for had many companies, so you're clearly a fan of it. But
yeah,
talk to us.
Well, especially for medical technologies and procedures, doctors and engineers and companies need to work together. There's no other way to make progress. It has to happen. I was very engaged politically at that time, spending a lot of time in Washington educating lawmakers. But at that time, you know, they just didn't understand. They thought that the relationship between physicians and companies was, you know, they put them on lavish trips. They you know, bring food and dinners and all that kind of stuff. And most that try to influence the choices that they make with respect to what products that they're going to bring into the OR or whatever. you know, we were pretty effective in getting across the point that that is absolutely not what it's about primarily. Of course, some of that does go on, and there's always in any of these situations good and bad actors. But primarily in medical technology, physicians must absolutely work together with industry, and it's unreasonable for them, for everyone to expect physicians to do that for free and, you know, forego earnings just to advance technology. They, of course, deserve to make a living out of whatever they do. And so those interactions are appropriate and necessary. And where it wound up going was about transparency in the Sunshine Act. The bar was set fairly low logistically because some interpretations of it would suggest if you're at a medical meeting and a physician is talking to a rep and they buy them a sandwich, that needs to be reported and posted on the website. So that can get quite annoying at that level. And I truly don't believe a sandwich is going to influence anyone's decisions. However, you know, where the Sunshine Act really came down was not to prevent the interactions, but just to disclose it. And quite interestingly, the legislators that put this in place, I think probably believed that patients would go on these websites, see how much money was being paid to one physician or another, and then avoid those physicians, believing that all that money must possibly be distorting their opinions. And my sense of what has happened is exactly the reverse, which is that, you know, patients are going on those websites, looking at what physicians are sort of deriving the greatest amount of capital from their consulting work, and recognizing that if that's true, they must actually be really know what they're doing. So they would prefer to go to those physicians that are actually consulting with industry rather than the ones that are sort of left out. I think we wound up in an okay place, and it's not a hot topic anymore, and everyone's just found a way to adhere to the rules without, you know, without it really preventing innovation to proceed.
Yeah, when that article came out, Josh, I was invited to give some evidence up on Capitol Hill, and I spoke to a number of members of Congress and senators, and I've always kind of enjoyed poking the skunk, if you will, and I asked them if they made their disclosures as honestly as we make ours. I was actually booed, which I took as I took that as a badge of honor, frankly.
Yeah. So, you hit a nerve there.
Yeah, good. That's good. Sometimes good to do that. Yeah, so right. Changing subject a little bit, you founded ExploraMed, as I mentioned, medical device incubator. And I've worked on a few innovations that we nurtured in those kind of environments, and I find it to be a great cost-effective way of progressing young med tech companies that can share best practices with each other. So for those of our listeners for whom this is a new concept, can you please characterize ExploraMed's mission and maybe how it helps the companies involved, and maybe give us an example if you think that's...
Yeah, sure. So these days, you know, an incubator is a broad term that covers a lot of different models. So they all are one to this, not like the other. And even, you know, let's say Foundry that was sort of created off of the basis. I remember providing our basic foundation materials to Alan Will and the guys over at the Foundry as they put theirs together. And separately, you know, Fred Khosravi and Mir Imran and others have all had incubated for Tom Fogarty. They're all very, very different, and they're very much about those that have founded it and the goals, skill sets, and motivations of those folks. And so my incubator, ExploraMed, is equally distinct in the way that it's created and the way we operate, although we do, across the board, I'd say many do use somewhat of the BioDesign process. Well, I mean, we use it religiously, others less so, but the basic idea is to chase after big problems and create solutions to those problems. And for us and for me, we are inventing these from scratch. We are using the BioDesign process, identifying big areas of medicine that we believe deserve some new innovations, and then going and finding those needs and really creating companies from scratch. So we actually don't take in companies. There are incubators that actually, you know, truly just incubate. They don't themselves have a process for creating anything. You can just show up and, you know, check in and make a deal to be in their space, use the facilities and work in a space. That's not ExploreMed. ExploreMed is, I would say, it's more of a birthing center than it is quote, a traditional incubator in the way that that word has evolved. But we are creating businesses from scratch. We're doing them generally one at a time. Once we have a business that has launched, maybe we'll start on the next project. But and the cadence of that has changed based on my own desires in my life, which is to not have such a crazy life. So we are creating probably about a new company every 3, maybe 4 years, giving the first company that's in house enough time to grow and get on its own legs and get its own financial backing, its own team, and sort of exit and graduate from the incubator before we're really diving in on the next one.
So what are you working on at the moment, Josh?
So our most recent company that is still in the space but has not formally exited physically is a company called Revel Aesthetics. And this is a technology for the treatment of cellulite, which is a skin condition that affects 85 to 90% of women. And very high percentage of them are very concerned about this. You'll know what this is if I'm sure every woman listening to this podcast will know. It's the dimples that form on the buttocks and thighs that can actually be seen through clothing. They can be fairly deep. They really look like divots, and they can be very distressing for women and cause them to change what they wear, change, you know, whether they go to the beach and stuff. It's actually quite significant for them. And historically, there have not been great solutions. There have been a lot of attempts and a lot of tragic failures of various drugs and technologies for this. And I think we've truly solved it. The evidence is all over the web. If you you can find all of our clinical evidence. The docs that are using it are posting their results. And fundamentally, we have a device that within a single setting can eliminate the vast majority of these dimples completely and durably in the long term. Now, there's some other overlying skin conditions, one of which is called laxity, which is related to, you know, getting older and your skin's less elastic. And I think that is not what this is addressing. So if you have, you know, let's say wrinkles or folds associated with a laxity, that's not this. This is a treatment for the dimples, which are quite common and prevalent, and actually not related to weight. Very thin women can have these. This is a feature of the underlying structural framework of the skin that results in, during puberty, when there's a fat layer, and when that layer expands as it normally would and should, it reveals a underlying structural issue that causes a dimple. What is the ideology of it? How does it form? Not really known, but it's possible it's there at, you know, very shortly after birth, and it only appears later at life. So anyway, the way that we release these is with a very focused, functional, minimally invasive tool that's introduced under local anesthesia, no pain, and releases the, let's say, ligament or underlying structural member that holds that portion back. And in many women, when we do that and then they stand up immediately after the procedure, the dimple's gone. And so it needed something that was that focused in the technology to go after it that focally to reduce the amount of bruising and pain that is associated with many of the other treatments. So that's Revel, and that's the one that's really getting off the blocks now.
Well, good luck with that. I'm sure you'll be hugely successful. And talking about successes, Josh, I've had fewer, but I do know that any lessons I learned have come from my failures, not my successes. Yes. How about you? For a man who's achieved so much, where do your best learnings come from? Do you have a set of rules, parameters that allow you to judge whether an idea is a good one or not?
Oh my gosh, yes. And I completely agree. And I've certainly had my share of failures. And it's a constant fight against failure. even many of my companies today. So for any entrepreneurs, including yourself, I think you know, like, we're constantly on the edge of complete disaster, that just trying to make sure that we survive to the next day and achieve the next milestone on the limited capital we have. And it's a very dangerous game to rest one's career, but also very thrilling and exciting when it works. I agree. My greatest lessons come from those failures. And I have so many that I couldn't list them all. Certainly I've had companies that have, that I've had to shut down. That's always a painful process. But it makes you realize that, you know, when you hire people, you should only hire only the people you truly need, because, you know, letting people go when you realize you need to thin the team is really painful. And people tend to be everything. And I would say, if there's one lesson that's been a thread throughout the entire experience, is that your choices about the people that you put into what roles is probably the most influential on the outcome. So people are everything. And that's probably the biggest takeaway. I could go down a list of many others.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. So a popular conversation in all areas of medicine today is AI, including medtech. What are your thoughts on AI?
Absolutely.
I think, are you playing in the space at all?
Yeah, it's cool, because AI has always been a word a phrase that I've heard from the beginning of my training. But it now suddenly feels like it's actually getting real momentum because of these large language models. The thing to remember about as the AI that we're looking at now is these large models are really recapitulating a massive amount of data that's been put in and thoughtlessly reconstructing it based on whatever cues or stimulus you give it, right? That somewhat simulates the way a human might respond to the prompt. But the difference is that there's still something going on with humans that are able to go outside of the prompt and think more holistically. And that's not what these models are doing. I think it's going to change everything about service medicine, for sure, and probably many other pieces of medicine and surgery as well. It's not a panacea, but it's a very, very helpful tool. But I think where it's going to have its greatest impact is actually in lowering the cost of delivering care on a direct basis, because for the most part, many of those interactions could be substituted for an AI interaction. And that's going to reduce costs substantially. So that's the biggest fear I have, is not, will AI be successful, and does it have a big role, and could it substantially reduce healthcare costs? I think those are all yes. We are going to have a future where you and I will, as a first point of call, whenever we need something, interact with an AI engine to diagnose and even prescribe medications in the future. Many of that is rote. Many of that is very off of, you know, proven databases and flow models. And it's only when we feel like we're not liking the answer we're getting, or it's not working for us, that we're going to escalate and need to talk to a human. But for the most part, a vast majority of our healthcare in the future, it's going to take laws to change, regulatory, a lot of changes ahead. But that's how I see it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I want to come back to that theme. But in the interim, anything else over the horizon, any sort of broad areas of healthcare innovation that excite you?
You know, I would just say, and I know you have probably a lot of listeners who are innovators or want to be innovators, is that, you know, for better or for worse, there is so much to do in medicine and surgery that to make things better for patients, that I will, you know, encourage everyone who has an interest to go into it. There is no bars. I am constantly excited. One of the reasons why I've gone from one field to the next is I just keep on finding great things to do. And everywhere I look, there's a big problem that needs to be solved. I'm not always able to solve them, but I know someone eventually will. But there's no shortage of problems that that are afflicting the human condition. And there's just no better place to innovate than improve people's lives. So I think there's no great one space. All the spaces are great. And go where your heart leads you.
You know, I agree with you. And I've recently roped a mate of mine in who has been very, very successful in software in the legal space. And I ran an idea by him in the medical space and said, you know, the beautiful thing about this, my dear chap, is you can go to bed doing, knowing that you've done very well, and you've done very well by doing a lot of good. Whereas if you're just helping someone in the legal space, yeah, I don't know about that. So I want to come back to something you said and sort of weave it into a bigger question. Big range of new technologies, and it's growing. The population's growing. The population's aging. So a three-part question. You just published an article about the time it takes from authorization from the United States Food and Drug Administration, FDA, to Medicare, which is the payment system, for those who don't know, for older people, for new medical technologies. So first, that element. Second, how do regulators like FDA deal with tech that is truly breakthrough, like AI?
Yeah.
And, you know, can we not move away from prospective, randomized, double-blind clinical trials, which frankly are tough to do with devices, and into more registrational ongoing trials so that we can get stuff to people? And finally, you mentioned the cost. America spends roughly $1 in $5 dollars of GDP and doesn't even treat 100% of the population. How are we going to pay for all this great new tech and medications? Three questions in one. It's a bonus episode.
Yes. You covered a lot of ground there. I just attended a meeting at JP Morgan where all the top current and former heads of the FDA gathered, and zooming in were Jeff Shuren from the device division, leading the device division, and others, you know, so it was a great meeting and gathering the minds. And for the first time, I'm really hearing regulators saying that the laws need to be changed because they were not constructed in a way that was very thoughtful about where innovation is going. And I actually completely agree. We've been working in this framework of PMA 510K, you know, clinical trials, the entire regulatory framework, honestly, does need a relook. It's going to be exceptionally hard politically, but it does feel like it's necessary. And I think one thing that should give the public general comfort is that we sort of tossed that aside in part during the pandemic, and look what happened in the course of a very short period of time. We had vaccines that were saving lives, diagnostics that were available to the public that were also saving lives. And I give the FDA and, you know, everyone credit for what it took to make that happen. And it's impressive. We can do this again, and we can do this always. And so, yes, you can, you know, pass this sort of test and get your product on the market. But in the real world, it gets used quite more broadly, and that doesn't necessarily compare to the inclusion exclusion criteria that were used in the original trial. And that's what's really happening. And then, so, you know, the real world evidence out in the real world for technology probably matters more than a rigorously designed, incredibly narrow and focused clinical trial that, you know, that really doesn't represent reality. Now, as I mentioned, the big cost in healthcare is people. It's administrative cost. It's not drugs and devices. They're easy targets to focus on because there's a price. But, you know, I think that people would gain much less favor if they said, you know, hey, doctors are making way too much money, or, you know, nurses, there's too. I mean, that's not a politically acceptable pathway. And I'm not saying that either, by the way. I'm just saying, let's look at the holistic where the expenses are. And holistically where the expenses are, and that's where they are. However, we can do better on the device side for sure. And many devices are expensive, and we need to evaluate how do we make those less expensive. Part of it is to lower the bar to getting them to market. Today, most medical device companies don't see a dollar of true profit until they can clear 100 or 120 million in sales. And in some cases, it's much more than that. That's a very high bar to achieve a profit. And that's just the beginning of the returns for investors who quite often, depending on the technology, have invested hundreds of millions. So it's a today a very expensive game that needs to find its way to be repaid. Otherwise, we'll lose the venture capital support, and then there won't be any innovation. So those are all the dimensions that probably needed to be adjusted to really, you know, go after what you're talking about.
That's a great answer. Thank you very much for that. My one caveat would be, I think we all need to do a much better job educating the general public, because there's this narrative that runs through society that the vaccines weren't safe, they were never approved.
Oh, yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. And I think we've got to do a better job and get rid of all the negative echo chamber on the internet. Josh, final question for you. I ask every guest, I love it. If a magic genie could grant you three wishes in your areas of healthcare, what would they be?
So I deal with regulators, I deal with payers, I deal with, politicians and legislators, as well as innovators and investors. So I see, I'm really in the entire ecosystem. I have contacts across all those and understand the dynamics. And I'd say if everyone could just truly be patient focused, I think that would be the first step. The first wish is that we all just sort of really think about the patient experience and try to be patient focused. And I think that one step is going to move us all in a direction together. Sometimes I find it and sometimes I do not. And then I would like, my second wish would be that for everyone to be reasonable, because there's a lot of unreasonable positions, positions that are taken that are not as sensitive to others. I'd like us all to recognize we're in this together. We have to work together, and nothing is black and white. It's always a little bit of gray, and we need to find a reasonable path. And we just can't take an approach that, block payment for a new technology to find any way, regardless of whether it is, not even caring whether it's actually going to save money or not, but just making it hard for everyone, because that seems to be a way to stop, expenses. That's not reasonable. And so I'd like to see everyone be reasonable. And I think those would be my first two. And I guess if I get a third, I would just say, let's just be kind to each other.
Yeah, hear, hear. Someone once said to me, we can disagree, just let's not be disagreeable.
Yes.
So, Josh, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. I really want to thank Professor Joshua McCower for being with us today, for all you've done and continue to do in medicine, and for the music, by the way, and for being a real inspiration as to how to live your life. Real pleasure to chat with you, Josh.
Same here, Jonathan. A real pleasure as well. Thanks for having me on, and congratulations on all your achievements and for this podcast.
Oh, that's very kind of you. For the benefit of our listeners, I usually see this nice gentleman across the room at a meeting. He presents, he comes in, and then he disappears before I can say hello. So It's true. So, folks, please check out the show notes. We'll put some links in there for you so you can learn more about Josh and all the great things he's doing. Please subscribe to this podcast so you never miss an episode of the EMJ podcast. Check out the archives, tell your friends, blah, blah, blah. Like us on social media. You know the shtick. And please join us next week for another fascinating episode. Until then, I'm Dr. Jonathan Sackier, and I thank you for listening. Please, everyone, stay safe, stay well, stay curious, and as Josh said, stay kind. Bye for now.